Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we meet a remarkable woman. Erica Hunt is a poet, social justice organizer and worker, black philanthropist, a specialist on gender and African-American issues and studies. She's worked as a housing organizer, a radio producer, a poetry teacher, a program officer for the New World Foundation, and more recently, the president of the 21st Century Foundation, where she administered funds to organizations looking at the root causes of social injustice. And I also mentioned before, she's also a strikingly fine poet. She'll be giving a poetry reading tonight at 7:30 in the faculty study at McFarland Library on the TU campus, sponsored by the University of Tulsa's Interdisciplinary Program in Creative Writing. It's free and open to the public. She's written three books of poetry, Arcade, Peace Logic, and Local History. Her poems can also be found in Moving Borders, Three Decades of Innovative Writing by Women, the Iowa Poetry Review, and the Virago Anthology of Women's Love Poetry. She joins us today to read her poetry and talk with us today on Studio Tulsa. Erica Hunt, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Rich. It's good to be here.
Would you start off by reading a poem for us?
Sure. I'm going to read the poem Proof. It's from a book called Peace Logic. Proof that we live in a broken world, and a broken world is unlivable. Proof that the carrot turns into the stick, and vice versa. Proof that seems normal, self-sufficient. Proof that we sometimes destroy things that are broken and can't be fixed, and sometimes we fix things because to live with them broken is unthinkable. Proof that we switch roles, sometimes to destroy things that are broken and can't be fixed, sometimes to fix things because to live with them broken is unthinkable. Proof that we learn to live with the unthinkable. Rectangles in tangerine, orange, and persimmon fall into place. They take our names, simulate full hands. Proof that having full hands leaves no time for questions. Proof that we can't help grabbing the sharp end, even when all the warnings are there. Proof that we find the hot water finds us. Proof in the tongue of ruin and burn, fluent in the language of minus. The forest comes apart and the trees have fallen. Proof, then, by reading it on paper, proof in unmarked bills. Line by line, our eyes fill up with witness. Mornings as clear as glass. Can stones be far behind?
That's nice. You know, as when I first read that, I said, you're writing proverbs or what you're doing, which was that something that was a part of this poem, sort of coming up with your own proverbs in a way?
That's really interesting that they're proverbs. And it might be that
The carrot,
there's something.
The carrot becomes the stick becomes the carrot.
Yes, they're, they are sort of sayings that have been turned on their heads. In a funny way, this poem is in some ways about, you're right, it is a kind of proverbial poem, a poem composed of proverbs. I would say that, what's that word? I think they're aphorisms. I like to write aphorisms.
Yeah.
They're sort of those kinds of things that people say to you that express something very concisely and very pointedly. I wrote this poem before 9/11, 2001, I guess. And when I looked back at the poem, I see a certain prophetic quality to it, which was the sense that we live in a certain kind of complicity with things not being right. And we, you know, it's a kind of thing where you can ignore something for a while and it comes and it gets you.
Yeah. And well, there's this sort of idea. I mean, you could read it on a number of different levels. One is sort of life, you know, about taking risk.
Yeah.
But there's also the sort of idea of risk as a culture.
Yes.
Live in a glass house.
Yeah, exactly.
Can stones be far behind? Huh?
Yeah. And that's finally where it settled. You know, like you can write, sometimes you write and you don't quite know where this is all going. And then it settles in those final lines. Mornings as clear as glass, can stones be far behind? And it settled there. And then there was some editing. You know, I take out things after I've, you know, produced a bunch of lines.
When you can read a poem in a variety of ways, the personal or maybe the political.
Yes.
What was the inspiration? Was it political or personal or both?
I think usually they're kind of both. I'm often in dialogue with other writers that I read. In this case, this was a dialogue with Franz Kafka, who's a favorite writer of mine. There is actually an excerpt from Kafka that begins the poem, and I should read that. Proof that inadequate, even childish measures may serve to rescue one from peril. So that's from, like, The Silence of Sirens. It's one of his little fables. And what happens is that I will read something and it'll make me go, boy, that's an interesting sentence or an interesting thought. And I will start to write from that, using that as a prompt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is that something that's one of the sort of the things you can go to the well to as far as a prompt, even a sentence out of a novel?
Yes, sort of. Absolutely. It can be something that I've read. It can be a piece of music, often can be a prompt. I love music. I live with a musician. It can also be a work of art. It can be anything, actually, that can be a prompt. Happily, I have been keeping journals since I was 14. And so since I'm quite on, I have about 40 years of journals. So that means that I can even go back to my own journals and pick a day, and there's a sentence there that can be a prompt for a new piece of writing for that day.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've done a lot of different things in your life. I mean, everything from ministering multi-million-dollar foundations to, you know, I think you've worked as a radio producer at some one point. You were a housing organizer, you know, working all sorts of social justice activities. Do you find poetry to be a daily part of your life, or sort of that thing you do, you know, okay, I've got a couple hours this evening, I'm going to see if I can write a poem? How do you work as a poet?
It's a great question. It varies, and it depends really how busy I am. But I am a regular journal writer.
So even if you don't have time to write a poem, you're writing something in a journal every day.
I'm writing something in a journal almost every day. And it can be anything from a, you know, quick note to-do list to, and when I was younger, I have these old journals, and it says, I owe so-and-so $12, and I would, like, write these things out for myself just to remember. But I think I write to know what I think, and that's so important. You know, everyone goes through a day, and we barely have time to think. We are reacting. We are rising to the occasion. We're doing what we must do in order to get through the day. Someone tells us to do something, or we know that we have to get something done, and we just run and do it, and we don't quite reflect on it. I write to know what I think. I write to know how I'm feeling about the big to-do list that, you know, constitutes most people's everyday life and my life as well.
Now, I think when we think of a poet or a writer, we would think of the journaling as being, here's some possible ideas for work, or here was a particular moment in my day that might be a poem someday. But it sounds like it's almost a meditation, an active meditation by reflecting in writing.
You can do anything you want with a journal.
Yeah,
and I
know.
Think it's about using the muscle. And it's using the muscle of translating your own thoughts and feelings, taking the time to know what the feelings are, and then translating that into something you do with your hand and something that you do with words. I wonder if, for instance, if everybody, as I do, narrates their day. now I've got to do this. Now here's this person coming towards me. You know, and in some ways it's capturing some of that narration, that storytelling that occurs in everyone's thinking, and at least in my thinking, as I go through the day. Sometimes I sit down and I say, now I'm going to write a poem. I'm going to take all of these materials, these different notes and thoughts, and I'm going to compose a poem out of these materials, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a kind of, you know, deliberate sort of going through the journals and writing and trying out different things on the page. I'm a handwriter. It's important that I write first by hand. I don't compose, you know, as some people do at the screen.
Or a typewriter for the ancient times,
right. But I could do that, but that's almost a different process. That's almost editing.
Mm-hmm.
I really want an unimpeded flow between what I'm thinking and my hand and the page. and to work with those constraints. And then sometimes a lot of dreams. Sometimes it's just writing down a dream fragment that I remember or a funny thought that occurs to me. All of that is material for poetry.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever have moments in the day where as you're walking, you know, busy life, in the moment for the most part, where you say, I need to remember this for tonight so I can write it down and it can be a poem?
Oh, yes.
Because this could be a poem.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I especially like puns. So I will write things down that are, you know, that occur to me, funny little puns that I want to keep. I also write down things that people say to me. Someone said to me, I want to read this little poem here.
Okay.
It's very funny to me. How it's done. First of all, son, 365 hot meals on the table every day. No reheats, no cold plates. When you get there, hot. Second, never show her your pay stub. So he's describing his cousin saying his marriage advice. Never show her your pay stub. It's like, whoa. It's hardcore. So I like to just, you know, I like to find poems too. Mm-hmm. You know, find poems and that and things that people say strike me as funny, and I say, okay. Now if I score that right, it becomes a poem.
You know? Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. My guest today is Erica Hunt. She'll be giving a poetry reading tonight at 7:30 in the faculty study at McFarland Library. It's sponsored by the University of Tulsa's Interdisciplinary Program in Creative Writing. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. She's been at the forefront of experimental poetry, poetics, merging music and poetry, as well as feminist thought and race studies, too, as mm-hmm. well. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You use music. You like to use music with your poetry. And we were chatting beforehand, and I said, you know, sometimes poetry and jazz, especially jazz, that seems to be the music that poets gravitate towards. Sometimes it works great. Other times it seems to work great at the moment. Then when you look at the poem later, it's like, what was that? What is the secret of making music and poetry really integrate and having, you know, each being substance of itself?
Sure.
Or can it be that? Can it exist that way?
Well, you know, poems are made of a lot of different features, but there are two sort of poles. One, it can go towards music, so it's mostly sound, or it can go towards meaning, where it's mostly, you know, sort of the layers of meaning and, you know, ambiguity and how that's manipulated in the poem. So the trick is, where do you position the poem along that axis? Music and meaning. Mm-hmm. And in working with musicians, you have to give up some of the meaning.
Uh-huh.
You have to move towards music. So what I have found is that I have had to adjust the form to work with the musicians and to truly be an instrument among many other instruments. So that means, I'm not the, you know, sometimes I can be the soloist. Like right. In an ensemble, you can be the soloist in a jazz ensemble, and then you can say your say and have your meaning be foregrounded, you know, or the poem as you conceived it. But when you're part of the ensemble, then you're more...
It's chamber music.
You're a musical instrument, which means that you repeat words a lot, you're repeating a sound a lot, it's more geared towards that. You have to use more intonation. You have to swoop your voice up and down. You have to get soft.
And a lot of times it's in the performance. And that's the other thing, is that the performance sells the poem. When you look at the poem on the paper, it's like, what was this?
What was this about? And so the skill there, and there are some really good performers who are able to, you know, be as great on the page as they are on the stage, right?
Right.
And that's the, you know, that's the way that people phrase that. But it takes some practice. And it takes some experience being with musicians and kind of understanding how musicians approach acoustical space and how they shape it, how they understand ensemble work, how they understand sort of working with the kind of pulse that's created in the moment. You have to be skilled around improvisation.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't on the page. So what do you bring to, you know, what are you bringing to this moment, to this creative moment? I do a little bit of it, and I have so much fun. With my husband, Marty Ehrlich, who's a jazz musician, I've played with him and with some other folks, merging poetry and jazz. But there are some great performers, and I follow them attentively. So I'm talking about people like Jane Cortez, who's a great poet and jazz poet and musician. He was married to Ornette Coleman and a great surrealist poet in her own right. Tracy Morris, who's a wonderful also poet and musician. Julie Patton, poet and musician. And to see them perform and to really become complete soloists when it's their turn and then, boom, go back into ensemble is quite breathtaking.
Mm. Now, is that where you lean in your own sort of poetry as far as the performance rather than maybe necessarily the page?
I'm a page writer. I'm a page writer.
So this is fun, it's definitely on the page.
It's definitely on the page. More, I've been venturing more into performance poetry. Oddly enough, I did this, I was asked to do the sermon at my church. It was scary. And I decided that I would do that rather than try to write a sermon, that I would actually do a riff on that great getting up morning. The reading had to do with it, too. On that great getting up morning, fare thee well, fare thee well. Mm-hmm. On that great getting up morning. And it really lent itself to being a complete sound piece. On that great getting up morning, we're going to get up. We're going to get up in the morning, you know, and then just continue to sort of, you know, riff on that and to use that and say that in every possible permutation of that great getting up morning. What are we going to do? What are we going to see? What will we be? Who will we be? Who will we be walking with? What will, you know?
Yeah.
And we, you know, and to and to sort of then turn it on its side and say, you know, we don't have to wait for the afterlife to actually be nice to each other or to be, you know, compassionate with one another or to bring, you know, that kind of the world of, you know, loving each other, compassion towards each other. We don't have to wait to be dead in the afterlife to do that. So that was fun.
What was the
congregation kind of sat there and went, yeah, they very much enjoyed it.
Now, what kind of congregation was this? Was this?
I go to a progressive, inclusive congregations of every race and every sexuality, identity, and so forth, and people really being all together to have a sacred space in their lives. And
I can see that going over in a traditional black church too.
Oh, absolutely.
You know absolutely. I mean, there are preachers
absolutely.
That do that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, it had and you know, there's elements in that church too. It's a great thing. So everybody's traditions. We all get a moment to have the tradition that we were raised with. But it's taking the best of that kind of vocal performance art and. You know, and it can be a preacher style, and it can be a blues style where the phrase is repeated, you know, in different ways, right? And each time it's repeated, it has a different meaning, right?
Mm-hmm.
But as you say, when you look at it on the page, you say, well, they're just saying the same thing over and over, aren't they?
Right.
You know.
Well, you know, it took me years to understand Gertrude Stein.
Yes, that's right.
And,
that's
you know, right. Gertrude Stein is what? And then you really have to say it aloud.
That's right. You say it aloud. And she's also saying, propounding that each person's essence has a rhythm.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So for every person she describes in, Making of Americans, mm-hmm. right, it's a different pulse.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's, and so people are phlegmatic, and some people are quick, and some people are, you know,
facile,
and some people are really complicated to listen to. And so she was really trying to say there's a, you know, everybody's got their own signature pulse and rhythm, and she was going to track them in this, you know, radical way.
Yeah. My guest today is Erica Hunt. She'll be reading her poetry tonight at 7:30 in the faculty study at McFarland Library, sponsored by the University of Tulsa's Interdisciplinary Program in Creative Writing and the Faculty of English. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, I can't let you leave without talking about your social justice work. You've done a lot of work in this. And what's interesting is, you know, maybe there's poetry that relates to this, but your poetry seems to be not a part of that. And I think the stereotype would be, you know, community organizer, you know, social justice. This poetry is going to be so earnest.
Yeah. Well, you know, I am a believer in a poetry of an expanded imagination, an expanded imaginary. I think that the social justice work is about doing practical things with groups of people that help build community and help to address inequities, remedy some of the inequities. And I worked a lot on things like the achievement gap between, you know, black students and the types of education that, you know, black and people of color generally have access to, and really trying to make sure that people have the opportunity to achieve. And I worked a lot, certainly, in response to Katrina. And Louisiana, Mississippi, and raised millions of dollars to help organizations rebuild their communities. But and those are all practical things and a good use of gift. But I also think, along with a poet that I much admire, Aimé Césaire, who Martinican poet, surrealist, wrote the wildest poetry you could possibly imagine, but also was the mayor of Fort de France, and also a deputy for Martinique in the, you know, the deputy of France,
right?
For 50 years, and wrote the most outrageous poetry you could possibly imagine. Just wild stuff. He was the father of negritude, which is the movement that really looked at creating black consciousness, really, in the Caribbean. That you have to have this place of the imaginary. It is what makes it possible for us to think beyond what it is that we are given, its constraints, its limits.
How does that place of the imaginary sort of inform that mundane grind of, you know, whether it's trying to bridge this the achievement gap and the resource gap for people of color? I mean, that can be just draining, you know, grind it out, slog it out, work. How does that having that imaginary place inform that day-to-day work?
Sure. It's the space. It's actually the space, because otherwise you would, in fact, be, you know, eaten by, you know, the odds, the circumstances. And there's, you know, people are inspiring. I often found that I met the most inspiring people working in their communities against all odds, with great courage, great ingenuity. You know, people who would, you know, figure out how to feed a lot of people with next to nothing, right?
Yeah.
Totally inspiring. But I also think that we need the space of the imaginary, because it's where we dream. It's where we say, you know what, this could be different. It's where you actually get to step outside a little bit of the grind of the daily. But finally, I have found that you can talk politics and you can talk social change and you can talk and talk and talk. But sometimes it's the poem. Sometimes it's the song.
Yes. That
right.
touches.
Yeah, that actually
that opens, yeah, opens the door.
Opens another door. And that's when people, you know, they can not only hear what you're saying and intellectually get it, but now there's all these other points of access where they get it. They get it. Just like that congregation, you know, it wasn't a sermon per se, but they got it. Because, you know, you have to address not only the rational mind, but also the other parts of us. We're not just one thing. And poetry does that so well.
Well, would you leave us with a poem today?
Oh, sure. This is my political poem.
Okay.
It takes a little while.
All right.
Okay. Invisible hands trade down the block around the world, down the food chain from forward to back to escape, the air-grabbing heat. The crop fails, the monsoon in June, a fluke of the weather, a storm of feathers, flowers whipped into a rain that claims the last village. Residents head out to the city to make money. They never make the money they seek. Instead, they make keychains, sneakers, baseball gloves, flame-proof nightwear, transmissions, stereos, computer chips, Gap jeans, rugby polo shirts, dolls with the features of Norte Americanos, or slave girls or Indian princesses living their lives in legend unlike their own, except for the unlocatable middle. Just in time, the chain continues unbroken to unwind the thing after the thing, a line of never-broken nouns. If it breaks, we fix it quick so the chain can never be broken. Even if it shouts out, a chorus set to shovel. The rocks never seem to disappear but become dust, a dust that lasts from morning to morning, chained to a logic we are doomed to follow. Invisible hands, rice the peas, spice the rice, circle the turns, turn on the presses, raise the letters, letter the spaces, address the edges before they bang into one another, mask the connections. Invisible hands, milk the spill, ship the ink, jump the rope, rip the chute, lay the trail, time the tear, eye the glass, bat the wing, bat the lash, brown the tan, fiddle the sticks, ride the herd, read the horde, hear the roar. Invisible hands, read the dim, damp the rhyme, rhyme the orange, toast their storage. Invisible hands carry the thread, thread the vowels, stall the calls, pour the molds, powder the walls, dent the bins, stamp the bills, core the questions, comma the nouns, time the charts, corner the square, square the curves, loosen the jaws, spill the beans, bill the cats, feed the beasts. It's years before a family will follow off the edge of the ramp into this putative new life where the past has vanished and the present is all time charts marked invisibly. Only visibly hot in a red dark of selective vision. In plain sight and out of sight, one hand tries to clap the other. As in the phrase, give me some skin. The slap of palms, right hand to right hand, empty. See, no weapon here. We come in peace. We come out of the hypnotic circle that orbits and holds us in constant bind of stick-em-up and lap dancing, out of rigged destiny, across the violent border of property and oblivion, where hands can be detected once again in the bric-a-brac of the world.
That's a great poem. Great poem. Great rhythm. It's wonderful. Erica, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Erica Hunt speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. You can hear a poetry reading by her tonight at 7:30 in the faculty study at McFarland Library, a program sponsored by the University of Tulsa's Interdisciplinary Program in Creative Writing, the Faculty of English. It is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent shows, log into our new website at publicradiotulsa.org and you can look at old programs and listen to them or subscribe to the Studio Tulsa podcast at the iTunes store. Stay tuned for remarks by the president, news conference coming up at noon. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening to Studio Tulsa.